the community what it takes in order to not forget those who had us in their forethoughts while they were out there saving our country. So again, I'd like to thank you both very much for coming onto the show tonight and sharing with our members the good works that you're doing. I'd also like to remind our listeners that the monthly Coalition of Black Trade Unionists meeting will be held on the second Tuesday of every month at the Oregon AFTME, that's American Federation of State County Municipal Building. It's called the William Lucy Building, located at 206025 East Burnside, and the meeting starts at 6 o'clock. So again, I want to thank our brothers for all the good works that they're doing, and I look forward to seeing if I could help out at your day of service. And once again, holla!
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Occupiers, a reading and book signing with Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky on Thursday, November 12th at the Q Center in Portland. The book traces the occupation of Zuccotti Park and some of its counterparts across the United States and around the world, from inception to eviction. Even if the movement fails to achieve radical reform, Gould-Wartofsky maintains its offshoots may well accelerate the pace of change in the United States in the years to come. Again, that's The Occupiers, a reading and book signing with Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky, Thursday, November 12th, at the Q Center, 4115 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
President Obama visits a federal prison. There's a call to federal prosecutors to lessen the use of mandatory minimums. There's bipartisan congressional support for reform. Tune in to Prison Pipeline to hear national leader Van Jones, who believes now is the time to end the mass incarceration industry in America. That's Prison Pipeline, November 9th at 6:30 p.m.
And the first one now will later be last, for the times, they are a-changin'.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline coming to you from KBOO. I'm Ruth Kovach, your host tonight, and with me are several guests, Karen James, who many of you know, Eric Rise and his wife Kelly, and we're going to have a good time. But before we get started talking about anything, I'm going to ask Karen if she wants to tell us some news that she has.
Yes, thank you, Ruth. I have some very sad news. We are sad to announce that our dear friend and founder of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous, Corbett Monica, passed last week. There will be a ceremony, a celebration of his life, but it's not yet planned. So we're asking everyone to watch for that information on the DDA Facebook page. And that is at Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon. Now, Corbett Monica as founder of DDA, has touched so many of us both in and out of prison. And we hold his wife and the entire DDA family in our hearts and our prayers. Corbett, from all of us, peace, love, and blessings.
Thank you, Karen. You said that very well for all of us. And of course, we certainly agree with everything that you've just said. Appreciate your bringing that news, even though it was sad. And now to my guests, Eric Wise and his wife, Kelly, are here. Kelly's going to keep very quiet, but that's okay. She's here and she'll be listening to everything he says, so it'll probably be quite true. And that's always good to know. And Eric, to start with you, how old are you now?
I'm 47.
You're 47. You don't look a day over 45, really.
I appreciate that.
And when were you incarcerated? From what age to what age?
I went in a month after my 17th birthday, so that was January 31st, 1985.
And how long were you there?
I did 10 years day for day. I was out 7 months and then returned for a parole violation for 17 and a half years.
So the parole violation got you more time than you had already spent.
Huh? Correct.
Well, anybody who's out there on parole, pay attention. It's they got a lot of rules, and you better follow them, or you'll be back in there for a long time. So when you were released, did you have any problems looking for housing or employment?
Unfortunately, in my situation, I mean, not unfortunately, but fortunately in my situation, I didn't.
So tell me about your background.
I grew up in a typical broken home. My father had been murdered by a Portland police officer in the 70s. The officer is the only officer to ever be convicted of murder while in uniform in the Portland police history. My mother had a history of alcohol and drug abuse, some prostitution. There were stepfather was violent. Vietnam vet, had his challenges in his life with violence, alcohol, drugs, gambling addictions, and along with that came just inappropriate behavior. Wasn't conducive to a good home life. My mother divorced him, married another father who was an excellent provider, but not a very good father figure, a role model. He would work all day. We had food on the table, but there was nothing outside of that as far as mentorship or anything like that. So I returned to drugs and alcohol. By the age of 14, I was on my own on the streets, providing for myself. Ended up in just places up and down the West Coast. I ended up in drug treatment when I was 15. It was a 30-day miracle shot. Didn't last. I was sober 2 months. Got back into trouble again, full-blown addiction. By the time I was 17, a month after my 17th birthday, I got involved with a couple individuals. The chemistry was really bad for us. We fed off each other's negativity and just perpetuated it. And unfortunately, I took the life of Mr. Anderson. I was sent to JDH. I was remanded and then went to prison from there for 10 years.
For 10 years. So you were convicted of a violent crime, which is a whole different path to walk for some of the other folks who are sometimes put into prison for minor drug charges and spend 4 or 5 years there because they had too big a bag of pot or something on them when they were arrested.
But correct. I worked hard to get there, unfortunately.
That's okay. And when you came out, did you have problems looking for, and I know the answer to this. I was going to ask you if you had problems looking for housing and employment, but you have connected yourself with Iron Tribe, isn't
correct.
That true? And that's where you found your housing and employment. So first, for those who don't remember Iron Tribe, which we've talked about more than once on this program, tell us about Iron Tribe. What is it? And so I'll give you 2 or 3 minutes for that.
Okay, Iron Tribe was founded by Harold Barrett-Cubbage and Sean Bauer while they were incarcerated. It was a vision that they had. They were cellies, and they came to a point in their life where they realized that they wanted to take a chance on themselves to better themselves, that they were worth more. And they had a vision. And when they got out of prison, they were all going to college, and they took all their college money they had spared, and they decided to to get a house. They all rented a house. It was a number of individuals. So the first house was on 212th and Division was the first house they had, and it was a men's house. And then one of the brothers that were there, his girlfriend was getting out. And so they decided, well, yeah, she could stay for a little bit. So it became co-ed housing. And then that couple ended up getting their kids back. So yeah, I guess they could stay too. So then we became family housing.
That's
so
good.
And that's what we are today, is family housing. Right now we are a community organization that provides support and understanding with wraparound services to help individuals with whatever their struggles are. The iron means we've been in trouble, and the tribe means that we're family.
And so this is the organization that, as soon as you were released, you went to the Iron Tribe accommodations.
Correct.
And so on, and they have provided housing and an income for you and kept you busy and maybe out of trouble too.
Right. I've had a few jobs other than Iron Tribe. Iron Tribe pays me right now. I work as the case manager for the 10 paid houses that we have.
It's 10 paid houses?
Yes.
Right. Wow, they've grown.
Well, we have 14 houses, actually.
Really?
We have 4 houses that are DHS contract houses. So it's a DHS programming where families or mothers trying to get to reunite their families can live, and we provide counseling, mentorship. There's some place for they can leave their children for a little bit so they can go out and go to work or go get an education. And that is the biggest challenge for single parents. They make more money sitting on welfare than trying to go to school or get a minimum wage job with childcare. Childcare is just a huge expenditure.
Right.
So they can leave their kids at home, go get educated, go get a job, better themselves. And then after a year or 18 months, whatever their length is in that program, they have some wherewithal to be solely independent.
Now, do you recall what year they started that?
This was in the last probably year and a half when we got our first contract, maybe 2 years. With DHS. We've had various contracts with counties.
I knew both Bear and Sean when they were still incarcerated. Correct. And they talked to me about their dream, and I tried to encourage them, but they didn't need any encouragement. Once they got the idea, they were determined to go ahead with it. And since then, I have visited their facility and so on. And
right. We just moved offices recently. We're no longer at the Tombstone. We are about half a mile further down the road.
Is that right?
Okay. Yes. But it's a nicer office, actually. Unfortunately, opened a marijuana dispensary in the same parking lot as where we were at. I mean, that wasn't conducive to what we want to do.
Well, I want to say good things about Iron Tribe. I don't want to spend the whole program on it. But folks who are recently released and they get directed toward Iron Tribe, I just would like you to say they have my endorsement as being something that would be very worthwhile to help you through the transition after being released and incarcerated. They're on the right track there, and good for them.
Appreciate that.
And you didn't have any problems in looking for housing or employment because you found it all right there with Iron Tribe.
Correct.
And what kind of support did you have besides Iron Tribe? Did you have family support or agencies?
No, at the time of my release, I was doing life without the possibility of parole. So my only concern was having $250 to $300 on my account in case my TV blew up.
Mm-hmm.
I would always have a job. I had housing. That's all my concern was.
Did you have a car?
I didn't need one in prison. I was never getting out. So that was my only concern. So I wasn't saving money for a future plan, because I didn't have a future plan. So on February 2nd of 2012, I had received a letter from the parole board, and they told me in 2 months they want to see me with a parole release plan. And they ordered a psychological evaluation, and they were going to see me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went from going nowhere to the possibility of going home, and had nothing. And I just happened to see somebody from Iron Tribe on the activities floor at OSP, and I engaged with him, and he asked me to write a letter to the office, and they returned my information to me and asked me, well, explain who you are. You know, how do you do that? I wasn't really sure. So in my grand wisdom, I sent them a copy of my psychological evaluation I just received.
Okay.
And they were taken aback by it, but they laughed. But it was that honesty, willing to put that evaluation up there. That
sure. Bear, good for you. That was a good decision.
Bear wrote a letter to the parole board saying that they were going to cover my housing, they were going to provide me full support, and which was anomaly. because that's not the type of program that they have normally, but they just realized the extent of my time, how much I've done, and my honesty and willingness to change, to become a better human being, that they were going to do that. And the board basically told me that without that support, I would still be in prison today. Today would be my review date. Mm-hmm. I'd have another hearing today because it's been 3 years to the day that I've been released.
Well, good for you. And you're not back in.
No, I'm not. I do go back in, but I'm not back in.
No, there are so many that come out and they get back to the old friends and the old path and they're back in again. It's recidivism is a serious problem.
Yes.
And it's very hard to just stand back and say recidivism is, you know, just a weak character or this or that. All the temptations that are there for folks recently released are very real.
They are.
And staying out is an accomplishment, one should be proud of when you've been incarcerated. You stay out, and if you celebrate 3 years that you're out, or 10 years that you're out, or 20, I say good for you, because it isn't that easy. It's
well, the biggest challenge for individuals getting out is a sense of belonging, mm-hmm. a sense of community. Mm-hmm. A lot of people get out, they don't feel like they belong to anything.
Which is why I asked you about what you had for support and family.
Right.
Iron Tribe has been your support.
They are my family.
Right.
They
right.
are. I bleed Iron Tribe. That's honestly, that's mm-hmm. what I do. We have social gatherings. We have a meeting once a week where you can come and not have to explain where you've been.
Well, this is KBOO bringing you Prison Pipeline. I'm Ruth Kovas. I have never presented a Prison Pipeline show without reminding people that if you are friends or family or loved ones of someone who's incarcerated, support, 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 because that's what makes the difference between them making it when they get released and not making it. And if you can do anything, whether it's to send them a silly little greeting card now and then, or actually go to visit, or actually send them money, if you have any feelings or caring at all about someone that you know or love, support them. They need it. They really need it. And I'm glad to see that you're doing fine. I think you're safely out and not going back right now.
It's not on my 5-year plan. I can guarantee you that.
And the future looks good for you?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
I currently do go back into the institutions for various events.
So the DOC Nonviolent Communications Program. Before we started the show, you made a reference to that. Talk to me about that a bit.
Well, I've taken, like many individuals that have done extended periods of time, pretty much every course they had to offer. And although the majority of them were all insightful, it was the nonviolent communications that really, I feel, is the by far the best program offered in DOC.
DOC is Department of Corrections.
Correct, Oregon Department of Corrections. It's a extensive program. It takes time to go through, as you know personally. But everything I learned in it challenged me to change.
Mm-hmm.
How I talk to people, how I interact with people, listening. Actually, be an active listener instead of being concerned with what I want to say or what point I need to get across.
So can you define nonviolent communications. That's a term that we use often, but listeners may not be familiar with the program. What are nonviolent communications?
Well, a lot of time when people speak, especially if we're insecure, and the reality is most inmates are insecure. Mm-hmm. They're not meeting their needs to feel safe or secure or loved or that type of thing. And when somebody speaks to us, we take it as a challenge, that there's a threat. Because we've been threatened, we've been in fear for so long. And even the remotest sign of any kind of disrespect, our thought processes change and we mm-hmm. become defensive. So we're not hearing actually what's being said. We just react to what's being said. Mm-hmm. And regardless of what, we don't even care what their intention was. We want to protect ourselves and put these barriers up, put these false masks up. And we might miss half the conversation.
Well, I've been known as a big kidder, you know, and one of my favorite ways to joke and kid is sarcasm and exaggerations and just plain old fantasy things that I say that aren't even true at all. But I say it with a laugh, and I think that everyone knows it's a joke. But as I matured and took a course in nonviolent communications and a few other things, I've learned that there are a lot of folks out there that have baggage that you push a button and you can cause a great deal of stress and distress to someone without knowing it. Just one little reference, one little comment, and you've upset them for all day, you know. And I keep thinking of typical comic movies where the person who does such a thing is shown standing with their holding out their hands saying, "What'd I do? What'd I say?" You know.
Right.
Well.
Well, it's that worldview. That's why the nonviolent communication, the communication process takes longer. Uh-huh. And we're such a fast-paced society. Even in prison, conversations fast-paced. But it has to, inside, we've been all controlled to communicate in a certain manner. And a lot of it's fake. It's, and everybody inside, if you're listening to me right now, you'll know this. So you sell in, "All right, brother, I'll see you later, bro." And you nod your head to everybody. And they close the doors, counts over a half hour. You get back out there and you're doing the same. "Hey, what's up, bro? How you doing, bro?" You just checked in with them a half hour ago, but you have to do it again within 30 minutes because it's ingrained. And it's a defense mechanism because there's just, oh, we want to make sure everything is all right. And we don't have any wholesome conversations in there, really. There's no wholesome conversations because it's a thing of distrust and fear. So being able to sit down and truly engage with somebody and find out what their worldview is, and what their goals and their ambitions are, that's true relationship building stuff. And it's hard to do in prison.
Yes, it is.
It's very hard to do. And
trust is a very difficult thing.
In life, it is. But in prison, so much more so.
Mm-hmm.
Because not everybody's well. That's not everybody's right. Well in prison. We have challenges. There are challenges and barriers. And overcoming them sometimes is insurmountable for some people unless they have some kind of peer guidance.
So you evidently took part in a DOC nonviolent communications program. There are quite a few programs offered to prisoners. Most of the best ones are voluntary. And if you're incarcerated now or about to become incarcerated, or you're a friend or loved one of someone incarcerated, most of those programs are very, very good.
Yes.
And they're there for the taking, but it's like trying to lose weight, trying to get off alcohol and drugs, trying to get a promotion on a job. You have to put yourself out there. It's what you put into it that determines the result you're going to have.
Well, a lot of it is, in prison, there's a lot of talking. And you'll be on the phone. I'm guilty of this as well when I was in prison. I'll be on the phone talking to somebody and telling them, "Oh, I'm doing everything I can never to come back here. I promise I'm doing everything I can." But if you're sitting on the yard and you haven't taken any particular course that's available, mm-hmm. you've made the choice not to take that, then you're not doing everything you can.
That's a good point. Thank you. Say that again.
Yeah.
If you haven't taken the course, you're not doing everything you can.
Yeah, everything you can is everything you can.
Mm-hmm.
Not being lazy, walking around the yard, just BSing. I mean, if you truly want to change and take a chance on yourself, because each of us is worth so much more than we give ourselves credit for. Mm-hmm. Even people that are successful every day, we can improve ourselves, become better human beings. And that was the ultimate goal.
And some of those programs provide interactions with the incarcerated folks that are very real. They send volunteers. They run little workshops. They yes. have weekly meetings, monthly meetings. The drug addiction and the alcohol programs inside
Correct.
Of the prison are very active, very well run by professionals who have been doing it for years and know exactly what they're doing. And I think, did you ever happen to meet any volunteers that were special?
Over the years, there have been a few. Volunteers, honestly, were my only visits for well over a decade. I didn't get family visits. I didn't have friends. I worked real hard to ostracize everybody that was ever close to me. So when I was going to Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous, if I was in the Lifers Club or the various clubs that I was in, those volunteers, those individuals that came in and donated their time, that was my only connection to the outside mm-hmm. world, and I cherished those times. So,
did you keep in touch with any of those volunteers?
Well, I did meet my wife. She was a volunteer inside at Columbia River upon my release. Uh-huh. I was there for my last 2.5-3 months, and after I got released, seeing her various AA functions, uh-huh. One thing led to another, and now I'm happily married for 2 years.
2 years, that's great.
I'm living the American dream. I've got a wife, 2 dogs, a house, and I'm in debt a little bit. That's the American dream.
So. I guess so.
And one thing I want to say is I don't want to come off as all the cats out there that know me. I'm not self-righteous. I'm not better than anybody else. what I found that is that if I'm truthful in everything that I do, especially brutally truthful with myself, my life will become infinitely better. So I try to do the next right thing. And
I think one of the greatest songs written that supports what you've just said is "Take a Look at the Man in the Mirror."
Right, Michael Jackson.
That is so great.
It is. But that was the hardest thing, is being honest with myself. Mm-hmm. And that even comes to this point. I'll have, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 in a bank account or in my pocket, whatever, and I'll be at 7-Eleven, you know, buying a bottle of water. I'll look down, I'll see a pack of bubblegum there, and there's a part of me, my criminality, I want to steal that.
Yeah.
I want, because that's my criminality.
You and every little boy.
Well, but that's, I have to keep that honesty out there.
Right,
and share that, because I have, my biggest problems are alcohol, drugs. I have a criminality piece. Mm-hmm. And if I don't address that, if I don't call it what it is, it's going to take control. So I throw the light on it, take its power, and I use that. And it's, yeah, mm-hmm. it's funny that you have that much money and still want to steal that 35-cent pack of bubble gum. It's a sense of entitlement, all that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
But I address it. And that's the type of honesty that I'm talking about. When I was on the yard, I really didn't talk like this. I didn't really communicate with everybody around me like this. But those in my closest circles, my sponsor was in there. Mm-hmm. That's where I was honest with, because we talked about earlier that honesty is so hard in prison. If I was that honest with somebody there, it would become mocking. It would become mocking. My change in prison, believe, I wasn't like this. I was a bitter, bitter, bitter person in prison. I didn't like anything. I didn't like the closure.
Well, what changed you? Did the programs they offer change you? Or
That was the mustard seeds that were being planted.
Mm-hmm.
There was an incident when I was over at EOCI, and I was playing poker, and a situation happened, and I won't use the individual's name, but I detested this person because he was so negative. I mean, he was just brutally negative. Mm-hmm. And I made no bones about that, me not liking him. And something happened to hand, and my friend told me, "Oh, good job, little so-and-so." And I was like, "What did you call me that for?" He said, "Yak, just like him." And I was really sick. Yeah, I was miserable.
That was a good look in the mirror, wasn't it?
So I moved to the other side of the institution, right, because I didn't even want to deal with not only my friend, but that's how he viewed me. So that was the first process for me realizing, you know, I had to change. So I asked my other friends over there, I said, "If you see me in the morning and you tell me good morning, make sure I say good morning back to you. Not morning or what's up, dog, or anything like good morning, Michael, good morning, Jeff." And it was like pulling teeth, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I said, "If I don't say it, you can come up and grab me until I do say it." And it became a little game for a while. Some of these bigger dudes would just pick me up like an old rag doll and shake me around, "Good morning, Eric." And they're like, "Hey, good morning, da, da, da." So that was the first process. And it was slowly after that, this insightful things and willing
to
change.
Well, I've talked to you for a little while, and I just met you today, but you're obviously not an alcoholic or a drug addict. You don't have any of
I'm
the
recovery.
Signs. Are you able to take one drink? Or
no, I am an alcoholic.
Okay.
I am an alcoholic and a drug addict. I always will be. It's life or death for me. I take it very seriously, and it's not necessarily my life. I manage clean and sober housing.
Mm-hmm.
I do not tolerate excuses.
And so you don't believe in one little drink?
No.
Or one little, you know, that's good.
No, not at all.
Nobody thinks that you should, but that's the hardest part for recovering alcoholics, is to finally believe that they've been sober a long time. And it's so-and-so's birthday or their own birthday. Why can't I have just one little drink? You can't do it.
Well, it's that disease. Uh-huh. The U.S. government used the analogy of what gets terrorism. It says, we have to be right every single time. The terrorist only has to be right once.
That's true. That's
and it's
very
the same
good.
Thing with alcohol and drugs. We have to be right every single day, make those right choices.
Well, we're almost out of time, so you can make one sentence of any comment you'd like to share with all the listeners.
Brothers and sisters that are inside, you're not forgotten. Every one of our prayers, closing meetings, we always remember those still incarcerated in Iron Tribe. Iron is, we've been in trouble. Tribe is, we're a family. And believe it, even if you're an Alpha member and you're back, we still love you. We still carry the torch. And I would just ask maybe for a moment of silence for all those addicts right now still suffering right now.
I hate to have a silent moment on the air. They think they've gone off the air. So in our hearts, we'll share some prayers as soon as we go off the air for these folks, because it is very important to keep in touch. And I want to thank you for being here, and I want to thank Kelly for coming along with you, and I want to congratulate you that you're doing so well, and I hope that I don't take it for granted that you are doing so well. I know it's an effort every day in every way, and that I'm happy for you because you're not the rule, you're the exception. There are so many who try and have the same commitment and ideas that you do about how to get on the right path, but it is not easy. It is not easy. So I commend everybody out there who has been on the wrong path and has gotten on the right path, and there's a turn in the road every step of the way, and if you just stay on the path, that's what all we're hoping for all of you. So thank you again for being here, and thank you, listeners of KBOO, and good night from Ruth.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
President Obama visits a federal prison. There's a call to federal prosecutors to lessen the use of mandatory minimums. There's bipartisan congressional support for reform. Tune in to Prison Pipeline to hear national leader Van Jones, who believes